Here at Early Excellence, we specialise in early childhood education. We offer expert advice and guidance through training, consultancy and classroom design. With the Early Excellence podcast, we aim to inspire and support you as well as challenge your thinking. So if that's what you're looking for, you've come to the right place. Welcome along to our latest episode of the Early Excellence podcast. This week, we've picked out an episode to re-release that will really get you thinking about your practice and provision. So have a listen to my Early Excellence podcast chat with the inspirational Helen Hawes as we have a really in-depth look at physical development in the EYFS. How are you?
Hi, Andy. Good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. Yeah, not bad at all. Not bad at all. Thanks. We're going to be talking all about physical development, aren't we? Which I know is a real passion of yours, something that you're really interested in.
Absolutely.
And I'm really, really looking forward to talking to you about this because I know that you support schools in all kinds of different ways around physical development. And I find it really interesting talking to you, that in-depth understanding of actually what are we aiming for and what would you do to support children. So we're going to cover lots of different things, aren't we? Just before we get on to that, can you tell us a little bit about your background and, you know, how you became interested in young children's physical development? What was the starting point for it?
When I had my own family, really, Andy, I've always been heavily involved with sport for as long as I can remember, from grassroots level right up to national, both as a player, a coach, an assessor, and also a tutor and an assessor for national governing bodies. So getting coaches through the qualifications to deliver high quality PE and sport. And then I've taught PE in primary schools for coming up 20 years now. So I've always been really passionate about being able to develop skills and bring children out to be the best they can be physically for that sporting performance. But then I've sort of changed my approach with having my own family. Obviously, with my background, I was quite passionate about giving my girls the best start in life physically. So I've spent basically 7 years researching good child development and what can be done at home to support good child development. And it amazed me to find out things that I previously had no knowledge about. You know, content that would really help schools and families that's just not widely out there. It's not common knowledge. So I've sort of changed my approach with work with the aim of sharing the knowledge that I've gained to support more families and more schools to nurture that good all-round development in young children.
Fantastic. It is really interesting, isn't it, that when you think about, say in the early years, of course, physical development is one of the prime areas, isn't it? It's one of the prime areas for learning.
Yeah.
And yet, actually, you wouldn't always know that, I think. I know that sounds a bit controversial, but we don't really look into physical development to the same depth, I think, quite often, than we do other things.
Absolutely.
So phonic development, for example.
Yeah, classic.
Yeah, but phonics isn't one of the prime areas. And yet, actually, you know, physical development, what we know about young children in terms of physical development is that, of course, learning and development in physical development underpins learning across all of those different areas. So it's fascinating, isn't it, that actually we don't often talk about it specifically in as much depth as I think we probably should. So tell us about your current work in schools. And you go into schools and... when did that start? You know, when did you start supporting schools in the way that you currently are? How did that?
So I switched from the PE role into the work that I'm doing now after I had my second daughter who was just turned 5.
Yeah.
Basically, number one, she was like the textbook child. You know, slept brilliantly. Everything was hunky dory. Second one came along, but it was like, whoa. What's this that I'm dealing with? Completely different, you know, didn't sleep, difficulty weaning, just screened all the time, digestive issues, sensory issues. So it's what I've learned as a mum through my own research. I wish I'd have known prior to having the kids. So basically what I'm doing now is trying to support schools and families in tackling those difficulties that a lot of families face, because there's so many. When you think about it, there's literally hundreds of thousands of families and children up and down the country struggling with sensory issues or poor emotional regulation or poor physical development, but they're not getting the support that they deserve and that they need. So my aim really in school is to try and put strategies in place to support good child development, to overcome these, you know, the barriers to learning, to overcome the difficulties with the emotional regulation, with the sensory issues. And the aim is really not just to mask those symptoms, you know, putting short-term strategies in place. You know, we'll sit a child on a wobble cushion to give them more proprioceptive input to keep them focused for longer. That's great on a short-term basis, but what we aim to do is get to the root cause of why have these children got these difficulties and how can we tackle it on a, you know, to solve it on a long-term basis.
Yes, yeah. And are there quite common things that you do when you work with schools? Are there certain things that you tend to do quite a lot?
There's two sort of strands to what I do. So one is ensuring that children have those physical skills ready to learn them. So obviously, you know, the common things, the fine motor skills, have they got sufficient posture? Have they got good posture to enable them to sit in a chair in an upright position? Or are they fatiguing sitting off to the side, which is affecting the visual tracking and auditory processing? So it's about looking at how we can build those physical skills in setting by changing the activities that we're doing slightly. So, you know, if we're looking at a book, do we need to be sat on a chair where the children aren't gaining anything from that physically? Or can it be done in tummy time? Can the children be laid on their tummies on the carpets while they're looking through a book so that we're building the shoulder stability, the elbow stability, the wrist stability that's going to help longer term with their handwriting? Can we be changing activities to work on a vertical surface so that we're bringing in spatial awareness, we're bringing in visual skills? Can we work on a vertical surface while standing on a wobble cushion?
I've not encountered a wobble cushion before. Tell us about the way. I don't know whether other people do know about wobble cushions.
It's one of the most common aids in settings. So it's basically a circular disc that's inflated and it's got a slightly bumpy surface on one side and a more bumpy surface on the other. And okay. if you were to stand or sit on that, it just challenges the balance and the core. So we try and use that as much as we can in settings. So if a child is working on a vertical surface, great. But if they are capable of standing on a wobble cushion, what that's doing is challenging the core and the balance even more to develop those physical skills for higher learning.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Very interesting indeed. I think what's interesting about what you're talking about is that you're looking at physical development, not just as part of course, like a PE lesson, but you're looking at it holistically in terms of how physical development links to what they're doing every day
and absolutely
what skills they're needed for every day. And so in terms of your support within schools, is you look very much holistically at the whole child. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. I keep harping on about developing the whole child. That's my big message to schools. We need to think about the whole child. And basically, when you look into it, there's so much evidence. Without good physical development, we're not going to get good development overall long term. So it's really important that everything we do supports that physical development. And what I try and say to staff in different settings is what value is this activity giving to the child? What are they gaining from this activity? Can it be done in a different way so that we can be working on the physical whilst we're looking at, you know, the phonics, the math? Yeah. So it's just, it's looking at doing things slightly different. It doesn't require any more, you know, time. It's not taking up chunks of the day. It's just doing things slightly different to make a huge difference, to gain huge benefit in terms of developing those physical skills that will support all round development.
Yeah. This is fascinating. Do you find, I don't know what, whether you've noticed it, but I guess you probably have. Have you found a difference in terms of children's physical development following on from the lockdowns?
Yeah, I mean, there's various studies being done to show that hand strength has declined in the last 20 years massively. And physical skills in general in younger children are just not what they used to be. But particularly with the knock-on effect of lockdown, when you think children have not had that stimulation in terms of different sensory experiences, they've not had opportunities to go and play like they would have done. They've not been in settings. So they've been, you know, some children, when you think about it, have literally been tied to four walls, possibly with mum or dad or whoever, stuck on a laptop. What are they, you know, if they're working from home, what are they forced to do with those children?
Yes.
Yeah. We're very quick to criticize parents in these situations, but some parents have had no choice but to stick their child on a screen for hours on end because they're trying to hold a job down. And that we are seeing the impact of that in settings up and down the country. I think I know from the settings I worked in, it's really, really noticeable. The number of children that are coming in with really weak physical skills, but also additional needs. There's lots more children coming in that we're questioning for, you know, autism, ADHD, dyslexia. All the labels that say that there's something amiss somewhere in terms of development. There's a lot more red flags in the classes coming through now in the reception.
And are there key pieces of advice that you give to teachers and practitioners when working with children? And you've mentioned some of them already, and I'm just sort of particularly interested in that idea of, you know, you were saying about tummy time.
Yeah.
You know, of children being on their tummies.
Yeah.
That, of course, is one of those early developmental stages that children need to be spending time on their tummies. And you think you would relate it naturally more to kind of, I suppose, you know, a baby or a toddler, wouldn't you? That actually they're using that at that point in development. And I wonder how much of your work is about kind of tracking back through the developmental stages and saying, well, actually, the gap was there. And they didn't get that at that point, and maybe to advise that they need that at this point to fill that gap. I'm guessing. I don't know. But
no, you're absolutely spot on, Andy. And this is the issue. And again, you know, we're quick to criticise parents when we get a child in setting that comes in at reception and they haven't got these skills. There is a reason for that, and it's, you know, there's various reasons, but a lot of it is down to missed opportunities in the home. But to be fair to parents, it depends what support they've had. So I've had two children, I've had two health visitors. I was fortunate that I had young children before lockdown kicked in. So, you know, families through lockdown, some of them first time parents, they didn't even see a health visitor. They've had no advice. We're not giving families the support that they need to be able to develop the child to the full potential.
Yeah.
So what we're doing in settings is sort of going back in time and putting children through those activities, giving them the sensory experiences, a whole range of things we need to consider that really should have been done in infancy that they may have missed or they've not had enough of. Or it could be that they've had all of that, but something else has impeded on their development. But by going back and retracing, going through those again, we can improve that development.
Mm. Yeah. And does your work focus on mainly indoors, or do you look at outdoors as well and sort of supporting children physically outdoors too? You know?
Both, Andy. Yeah. I mean, I encourage, you know, I'm a big believer in getting kids outside in all weathers. There's a lot of opportunity outdoors for physical development. Sometimes it's easier to create those opportunities outdoors just because of space, depending on the setting. It doesn't mean to say that, you know, all the physical has to be outside. There's so many opportunities to develop the physical inside. And going back to those little suggestions that can make a big difference, one of the common issues that practitioners are reporting back is that there's more and more children coming through with speech and language difficulties. So one of the things I advise is there's some simple exercises that children can be doing to strengthen the muscles in the mouth. So there's different oral exercises that you could do, you know, 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes in an afternoon, that can make a big difference to the clarity of the speech. So it's just looking at ways of building those opportunities in without taking time out of the day. So it might be that while one member of staff's doing the register, somebody else is stood at the front leading those oral exercises, and the rest of the children are following those exercises. It might be that they're doing their oral exercises whilst holding a half plank position, so we're working on core as well. Kind of thinking outside the box to build in as many opportunities as possible to do, you know, so we're developing the whole child but without taking time out the day and putting more and more demands on practitioners that are already stretched.
Yes. Well, you're right, isn't it? That if you are going to make a physical change to your body, you know, to anybody's body, it has to be through continued use, doesn't it? You know, when you talk about athletes training or what, you know, whatever you're training for, it has to be something that is done on a regular basis or daily basis, doesn't it, really? In order that your body is used to that and you build that core strength. It's the same, of course, for young children, isn't it? That actually we need those opportunities on a regular basis. So the things that you do as part of a routine during the register time or as part of your continuous provision are crucial, aren't they? And sometimes really simple things. You know, for example, you know, painting. Painting could be done sat down or it could be done stood at an easel. If children are standing at an easel, then they are developing that core strength as they're painting, as well as that hand-eye coordination and the different physical skills in terms of using their arms as well. Of course, a very different way of working than sitting at a table. Yeah. And yet you don't often think in detail, I think, about what's happening physically within those moments and how actually if something's available continuously like that, then we're building strength, we're building core strength. And the same for outside as well. You know, the big physical movements outside are key, aren't they? You know, the lifting, the carrying, the balancing.
Absolutely. Yeah, which all helps with those major muscle groups, which without the strength in the major muscle groups, we're not going to get the fine tuning in the smaller muscles that we need for the fine motor skills for the pencil control. But going back to the working on a vertical surface, an easel, for example, if we can work big scale as well on a vertical surface, we're bringing in so many different elements. So we're bringing in the visual skills, the visual tracking, which is essential for reading. We're bringing in spatial awareness, which we need for our math columns, our positioning on the page for our writing. We can encourage children to cross the midline. So there's a lot of children now can't do that naturally because there's barriers in place, physical barriers in place. So we have an imaginary midline running from our crown down the centre of our body to our toes, which divides the body between left and right. And it's a dead simple check, actually. If you work in a setting, it's an interesting check. If you ask children to actually stand like a star and take the right hand over to the left knee, can they do that, or do they actually physically jolt when they get to that midline? And if they do, we're going to have issues with bilateral coordination, which is the ability to use two hands at the same time to complete a task such as tying shoelaces or holding the page with one hand and writing with the other. So this is the sort of thing, it's just taking that physical development to the next level, to improve awareness in our settings amongst our staff, because obviously the emphasis is on the fine motor skills for the writing. Yeah, that's the bigger. But we need to think bigger. We need to be thinking about the visual tracking. We need to be thinking about the spatial awareness and all those other things that quite often get missed.
Yeah, yeah. And we don't think in detail about that, do we? We often will identify certain things in terms of particular needs that children have and identify them as a special educational need.
Mm-hmm.
But we often don't see the physical part within that.
Yeah.
I mean, then we will often identify speech and language as an issue.
Yeah.
And not, but then miss the fact that actually this child isn't just developmentally delayed in terms of speech and language, but that actually it's a more holistic issue, including the gross motor movements.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting. I also think we often, because I think we put such a lot of emphasis on the process of learning to write, rightly or wrongly, I see a lot of teachers and practitioners focusing in on the fine motor control with children who have not yet got the gross motor control, and that actually I think there is a process involved there that I think we're missing out elements of, and that isn't going to help children in the long run. Is that something you agree with?
Absolutely, Andy. One of my biggest pet hates, it drives me mad, and I could offend a lot of people here, but I don't know why we are so obsessed as a profession with asking children to write their names every morning when they enter into the setting. Mm-hmm. So many children are not developmentally ready for that exercise, for that activity. And what is the child gaining from that activity? Yeah. Is that something that's going to infuse them to come into school to perform a task that they're going to be unsuccessful at? Would it make you want to go into the office?
No, it's a good point, isn't it? If you find something hard and you are hit with it straight away as soon as you come in, then you're not going to be massively enthusiastic. It is a good point.
We forget that we're dealing with little people. We're not just numbers there to produce outcomes for Ofsted and a rigid system. We're dealing with little humans that have feelings and opinions, and I don't think we give enough of recognition to that sometimes. We don't kind of put ourselves in the children's shoes enough, because the system expects that we do X, Y, and Z. But as a practitioner, I like to think, right, what is the child gaining from this activity? How can it be adapted to suit the needs of that child? And I would always say that we need to meet the child where they are at developmentally, because if we're not, they're missing out, they're not gaining from that activity. So if a child has no idea how to hold a pencil, even after they've been guided, something's amiss somewhere in terms of the development. So our job is to find out what the root cause is, what is that barrier to that skill, and address it. So it could be that, like you say, that child hasn't developed the gross motor skills. So could it be that instead of writing the name, if you do a bit of letter recognition, if you pin their letters, the name up on a vertical surface, can we encourage them to jump and touch the letters in the right order to spell their name?
Mm.
Yeah. So we're still working on the name, but at the same time, we're bringing in the visual skills. We're developing those gross motor, those major muscle groups for the gross motor skills, which in turn will lead to improved fine motor skills.
Yeah.
We're bringing in spatial awareness. There's so much more involved that we're missing.
Yeah, yeah. Just going back to that idea, if a child hasn't, you were saying earlier on that physically, in terms of the children's hands, that over the last 20 years, that children we're seeing more and more children coming into school without that strength or development in terms of their physical skills of using their hands.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you focus in on? Is that something that you do a lot of work with school? And if so, what does that look like?
Not particularly focusing on hand strength, because everything, if you follow things in a logical order, things will happen naturally. We don't need to be spending hours doing interventions for fine motor skills. Mm. We're wasting our time doing interventions in the wrong order, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So if we, you know, if the child hasn't got those good control of the body, if they haven't got good development of the major muscle groups and the gross motor skills, we're wasting our time doing those interventions for the fine motor. Yes, it will help to some degree. I'm not completely dismissing that. But if we get the basics in place first, the fine motor skills will happen much more naturally and much more quickly. And that's also true for a range of other skills. Like we said earlier about the ability to cross that midline, we're going to struggle with the bilateral coordination. So it's about looking at things holistically rather than honing in on, we're focusing on our writing. We've got to have excellent pencil control. We're going to build hand strength. We don't need to just work on hand strength. It's looking at things collectively. So like you said about, working outdoors, lifting tires, rolling tires, lifting crates, pushing, pulling heavy objects, carrying, lifting, challenged in children physically. There's so much involved in all of those activities that's helping with balance, core strength, core stability, shoulder stability, wrist stability, hand strength, developing the big and small muscle groups, the visual tracking. So it's just looking at things collectively rather than honing in on a particular skill, if you like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That makes complete sense. I think the big physical movements are something we don't focus in on enough.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that is about people being quite cautious about children taking risks, that they see the big physical movements as being risky as well. And that actually it kind of feels much safer if you're talking about a busy fingers area rather than children lifting and carrying big tires and stacking crates and so on.
Yeah.
But I can see completely the value of the lifting, the carrying, the rolling, the stacking things up, the big, big physical challenge. And I also think that it's, and you've mentioned this as well a few times, that when we're talking about physical development, it's not just physical development. So, for example, one of the things that I often talk about is that when children are lifting and carrying big, heavy things, we are challenging them physically. You know, if they're trying to move a tire or if they're trying to move crates or whatever it might be, big, heavy planks of wood, we are challenging them physically. So great, that's covered. But also, if something is so heavy that a child finds it difficult to lift, they're going to have to work together with other children to lift it. So already you're prompting them to be collaborative.
Yeah.
If children are collaborative with open-ended materials, then they're going to have to start to, in some way, communicate what we want to do with it and where is it going to go. Even if that's just using gestures, then actually they are communicating together as to what they're doing with those open-ended resources. Because it's not clear, is it, what this group of crates are going to be or what you're going to do with it. It's not clear unless actually we're going to have to work together on it. So I think you're absolutely right. I think that actually the physical development is one big part of it, but actually we don't see it in isolation. Learning and development is always most effective when it's meaningful. And it's meaningful when actually when the children see a point to it, when they're busy, when they're engaged in it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's just a case of building on it as well. Obviously, we're not going to throw these children in at the deep end and put them off life for coming back to our settings, but it's about building things gradually. So, it might be initially that they've no idea how to set an obstacle course up. So you might set up one end of an obstacle course and leave resources around for the children to develop that as they see appropriate and, you know, be there to guide and support. But as time goes on and they're more comfortable in their environment and exploring ideas and, as you say, working collaboratively, can we challenge them to say, right, well, we've been working in this space now, but what I want you to do as a team is we're going to work over in this space. And leave it open-ended. You know, how are they going to work as a team to get the planks, the blocks, the crates from there onto the field next door or wherever it is that you're going? Put the bikes, the scooters out. Can they transport them more efficiently using bikes and trikes and scooters? Or is it better that they're carrying and working together? And as you say, that brings out all the communication and the language and the problem-solving. By giving children that freedom to explore ideas as a team. And we do like to set challenges in our settings for children. You know, one of the things I like to do is more in the summer term is to get children bare feet and get the water out and set a challenge of getting water from A to B. So can we create a river without any leaks? And create a dam at the bottom of the river. And that is, you'd be amazed at how long a task like that can keep children engaged for. And the learning that you see and the enthusiasm, you know, the quieter characters can come out in those situations. You see the problem solving in action. You see the collaborative working. You see the communication coming out that you wouldn't see necessarily indoors or on independent tasks, obviously. But it's absolutely magic to watch it in action. It's absolutely magic.
Yeah, fantastic. Wonderful, wonderful. When I was chatting to you before, you mentioned retained reflexes.
Yeah.
So when we've talked before, retained reflexes. And I think it's a term that I'm not overly... aware of particularly so I kind of have looked into it a bit following on from when we've been talking about it, but I found it really interesting. Tell us about retained reflexes.
So I came across retained reflexes by basically researching around my second daughter. You know, I spent 4 years researching why is my child bonkers, basically. And I came across the work of Sally Goddard Blythe, who is so knowledgeable. I refer to her as the queen of reflexes. What she doesn't know about reflexes isn't worth knowing. And we are all actually familiar with reflexes. It's just not talked about. So to give you an example of a reflex, we all know that when a baby is born, if we put our finger across the palm of a newborn's hand, they will automatically close their fingers around and grip our finger. Mm-hmm. So that is called the palmar grasp reflex. Okay. So we're all born with a set of different primitive reflexes. They develop in utero in the womb, and each reflex has a different role for basic human survival. When the body realizes that it doesn't need those reflexes anymore, they should become what we call integrated. Yeah. So they become dormant in effect. They never completely disappear, but they lay dormant so that they can be re-recruited in the future if needed, for example, in times of trauma. What that does when they become integrated, it frees up for the next stage of development. So our primitive reflexes typically become integrated by around 6 months. And then that makes way for more mature reflexes, what we refer to as postural reflexes, which can take up to 3.5 years to develop. And they're connected to the higher centers of the brain, which is why it takes longer for those to develop. But Sally Goddard Blythe acknowledges that, well, she refers to a cluster of, when we get a cluster of retained reflexes, She refers to it as neuromotor immaturity and argues that it's a good indicator that something's not quite right in certain areas of the brain. Things aren't developing in sync as they should be. So it might be that there's a delay in certain areas of the brain. Now, reflexes can become retained for all sorts of reasons. If we go back to the primitive reflexes, we have several primitive reflexes that are designed to assist the birthing process. So we've got different neck reflexes and a spinal gland reflex, which are designed to help twist the neck and wriggle the baby to assist the birthing process down the birth canal to help mom. So quite often, if babies haven't gone through that process, C-section babies can be prone to those retained reflexes. Stressful births, prolonged labours. There's all sorts of reasons that can, all sorts of factors that can cause retained reflexes. It's not necessarily, you know, poor parenting. Now, the issue is that if a child has a retained reflex, it can massively impact on their day-to-day life, depending what reflex is retained and to what severity, because a reflex can be partially retained or it can be fully retained. And depending on how severely it's retained, that will impact on the severity of the symptoms and the difficulties that child faces. So to put that into context and give you some examples, the spinal gland reflex is designed to help baby wriggle down the birth canal. If that is retained for whatever reason, these are the children that can't sit still in a chair. So they're often mistaken for having ADHD because it's the reflex is elicited. It's recruited by touching the back. So they're hypersensitive on the back. So they don't like to sit in a chair. So you might find that a child can't sit still in a chair. So they're wriggling and they're up and down out of the seats, or, you know, they're forwards and backwards, side to side. They are the distracted child that's not able to concentrate and focus and attend. But lay them on a tummy tuck up at a book and read, they're absolutely fine. And this is where my work comes into schools, is it's trying to get to the root cause. So if a child is presenting with difficulties or, you know, unusual behaviours, is it behaviour or is there an underlying reason that's been missed by the health system or the education system? It's about getting to the root cause of why children are presenting as they are and facing these difficulties. My daughter had a partially retained Moro reflex, which is a common one. So if you have a child with sensory issues, 9 times out of 10, it's going to come back to a retained Moro reflex. It's the fight flight reflex. And it's connected to the fear paralysis reflex, which is how we perceive danger. So the two are linked. People will be familiar when a baby is born, one of the checks that they do is to do a little drop with the baby. And what should happen is that the arms flare out to the side and then immediately come back to the chest. That's good. That's what we want. That shows that the reflex is there and it's serving its purpose. But that reflex should be integrated in infancy. And when it isn't, the child presents with a whole host of difficulties from sensory issues, poor impulse control, which has been a biggie in our family, really poor emotional regulation, hypersensitive to things, mood swings, easily distracted. So you can see how all of those issues, even the sensory to some extent, can be mistaken for, you know, what we deem as poor behaviour. And quite often children are punished as a result of these behaviours that are completely out of their control. So it's, you know, it's when we work in settings, what we're ideally looking to find out if if these barriers are caused, if there is a barrier to this, these that's causing these behaviours, or is it chosen? Now, the good news is that the reflex issues can be addressed quite easily. And as a practitioner, I would always advise that if you suspect something is not quite right in terms of a child's behaviour or where they're at developmentally, go with your gut. Just because they're ticking all the boxes for the system, you know, they might be great at the phonics, they might be able to manipulate a pencil and produce neat writing. The maths, they might be flying in the maths. But are they really tense and sweating while they're performing those tasks? Are they able to sit with good posture during those tasks? Have they got good emotional regulation? Are they able to communicate effectively and form friendships? Are they able to recognise other children's emotions and needs? If something is amiss somewhere, don't just ignore it because they're ticking the boxes for the system. We have a duty of care to do our best in terms of all-round development for these children in our settings. And I also believe that we have a duty of care to support families as well. So I would also say, you know, don't be afraid to have these conversations with parents. Obviously, we don't want to alarm them by saying, we think your child this, this, and this. We're not there to diagnose. We're not in a position to say, yep, we think your child's autistic or ADHD or whatever. But have those conversations. Do you have this difficulty at home? How can we support you? We've noticed this, but the good news is we can do this to help. And if we look at how we support, how we address retained reflexes, if we address it in the early years or in early key stage one, it can be as simple as 10 minutes a day, 5 days a week, half a term or a term. We can integrate that reflex. And all those problems then just sort themselves out. They just subside.
Yeah.
And it's frightening to think that when it is so simple to address, we're not doing it. It's just getting missed by the health system and the education system. And there are so many children going under the radar because there's not enough red flags to raise concerns for, whether it be, you know, autism. We're not making those referrals to get those statements, which we know now is taking longer and longer because there's more and more children coming through with those additional needs. Mm-hmm. So it's about recognising the needs of those that don't present with major red flags, but are struggling in some aspects of day-to-day life or academically that would typically go under the radar, that if we leave, you know, it might not be so much of an issue now, but by the age of 7, we might get a point of school refusal and going into, you know, anxiety and mental health issues.
Yes, and I think that's always the thing that is striking to me around physical development particularly, is that there is a time sensitivity to it, isn't there? One of the reasons that physical development is one of the prime areas in the early years is because actually it's time sensitive. That in terms of many of these physical skills or physical stages of development, children do need to acquire those skills or those stages of development during the early years up to the point of 5.
Yeah.
Because often if they don't, then actually they will find it much more difficult to acquire those skills later on.
Absolutely. And they're older.
Yeah. I do sometimes see children, you know, who are older, who are maybe in year 4 or year 5, who say you're walking up the stairs in school, the steps in school behind them, and you notice that actually, although they are kind of in year 5, that actually they're taking one step at a time and putting both feet together on each step. They've not, you know, see, which is something that you would see for a 3-year-old child, perhaps.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't necessarily expect to see for an older child.
Yeah.
And yet, actually, it's much more difficult to acquire that skill later on.
I think what's often missed as well, Andy, is that when people see that there's a difficulty physically, like the example you've just given, we don't appreciate the impact that has on overall development and the impact of that on the child, creating difficulties for that child day in, day out with, you know, just performing daily tasks. But it will have a detrimental impact on some aspect of their academic performance. Again, going back to Sally Goddard White, she's referred to various studies to show that, you know, there's a strong correlation between children having poor physical skills and low levels in terms of the national curriculum. Mm-hmm. Everything is linked back to the physical. We don't think anything as practitioners about a child having poor posture. Well, you know, so what if they're slumped in a chair, if they've got a curved spine? Does it really matter? Well, yeah, it does actually, because if we're sitting children in a chair or on the carpet and they are sitting slumped with the head looking up at the board, what that's doing is putting constant pressure on really important nerves around the back of the neck and in the ears, which then has a detrimental impact on the sound processing. If the sound process isn't it where it needs to be, we that's going to have a detrimental impact on the phonics and the written word. So yes, it's only posture, but that's how it can impact on the academic side of things.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I would think that people listening will want to know more. So where did you start in terms of reading, or what books would you recommend to people? You mentioned already one, you know, in terms of research, but what would you recommend?
So I keep harping on about Sally Goddard Live, but I think she's amazing. I mean, this book, she's produced various books over the years. One's more sort of family friendly. So what, you know, with that saying that supportive families in getting the basics right and giving a basic understanding of how to support good child development from day one, and the importance of the family as well. There's then other books that focus more on the reflexes, but one book that sort of encompasses everything that she's done is Attention, Balance and Coordination, the ABC of Learning Success. I mean, it's heavy. It's heavy reading. But if you're really serious about understanding these difficulties, then that it tells you everything you need to know about the, you know, the reflexes and the impact that each has on the child. An easier read is Disconnected Kids by Dr. Robert Melillo. Now, he looks at things in a similar way to Sally Goddard Live. He recognises that children that have different labels, you know, whether it's dyslexia, ADD, autism, everything comes back to this disconnect in the brain, that the brain is out of sync. So he talks about how certain areas of the brain are developing as they should, but other areas aren't, for whatever reason. And we don't need to get caught up in labeling whether it's this, this, or this. What we need to do is just find the root cause and start tackling it. And he points out that what we tend to do is focus on the child's strengths, but what that does is exaggerate the gap and then creates further problems, because it's creating a greater mismatch between different centres in the brain. His work is it all aimed to bring the brain in sync, if you like. So the areas that are falling behind, let's play catch up to bring those where they need to be, so that those connections between left and right and higher and lower hemispheres can be where they need to be to help that child to function more effectively. Fit to Learn. Charlotte Davis is an ex-head teacher, originally from London. She's recently moved to York, and she is a consultant for Tomatists, which provides sound therapy to address auditory processing issues. But if you look at some of her case studies, it's absolutely fascinating, the work that she does. And she touches on reflexes as well. But when we put children through the exercises to address the reflexes, if that is done in sync with some sound therapy, it just speeds up the process much, much quicker. So she's given examples of year seven child, ADHD, anxiety, school refusal, and literally 6 months of the, you know, performing regular exercise with sound therapy. And we've got this happy, engaged learner, confident, completely transformed in, you know, in a matter of 6 months. So the support is out there, but it's just a case of getting word out and us as practitioners recognizing and acting on our concerns. There is support out there. It's just a case of recognizing when it's needed.
Yeah, absolutely. Helen, it's absolutely fantastic to speak to you, and thank you so much for joining us. All of this is, I find it really interesting. I think that the depth that we're going into here is a depth that actually in schools and settings we don't talk about enough. That real depth of understanding around physical development is, and how it connects to all of those other areas and why it's so important, is something we don't talk about enough, I think. So thank you so much for joining us. I know that people listening in will have found all of the things that you have to say really interesting. Well, and we'll challenge people, I think, to really rethink what they do and what they have in place in terms of routines and in terms of their practice and provision, both inside and outside. It will really, I think, challenge people and get people thinking. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Podcast. It has been really, really interesting and so useful, I think, to talk to you. So thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me on, Andy. It's good just to try and spread the word and get support for people that are struggling. And, you know, I just refer back to the early days of my youngest and what difficulties we face. And I just wish that we'd have known that then what we know now, and had a bit more support. So it's, you know, it's about getting word out to support settings, but families as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Take care. All the best.
Thank you, Andy.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So there you go. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you found the episode useful. Now you can stay in touch with all things Early Excellence by joining our mailing list and also, of course, following us on all of the social media platforms as well. Okay, have a good week, everybody, and we will see you next time.